This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Okay. So, first, I would like to thank the curators of this show. Can everybody hear me? Yeah. I really would really like to thank them, not only for having brought the show to Venice, but for having grouped these 16 practices together, and not just for the one show, but sort of continuing to try and understand what it has meant to bring these 16 practices together. So it's been a great conversation, actually, between the 16 people, and I think as evidenced by the controversy which has gone on tonight, which I hope continues into my talk. And there's, in fact, not such a discontinuity, I think, between the first two speakers and what I'm trying to do, because I think that as the last question posed to Teddy, which might have asked him what it is to bring this kind of practice to an institution, I hope that I will try and answer that question by saying it is a form of research, and that we hope that when we teach research to students, it's not that they replicate it in the same form that we do ourselves, but that they learn how to see things differently and how to become, in some ways, urban anthropologists and ethnographers and to do things differently. So in the sense that Rick Lowe might have started around questions of place, I think that the work I do really starts around questions of issues, and that's really what's motivated the work as I move from one project to another, is not sort of what defines the discipline of architecture, but how I can bring the discipline of architecture to other issues which might have a spatial component. So as part of that project, I have started this lab at Columbia, which was a sort of an innovation of our new dean that you, Mark Wigley, who has actually started tons of these labs. and they all do very different things, and I encourage you to look at the website. But the whole idea around our lab is that it really was trying to bring a model of, in some form of actually quite traditional, maybe, research, in that we're dealing with empirical data and trying to do different things with it than maybe what social scientists do with it, because, as we say, we're a lab of spatial information design, so we deal with spatial data. And as architects, we're somewhat, and planners and urban designers, we're somewhat of an expert, or we think of ourselves as experts in spatial data. And so we try and work with that to further questions about things. So this is our, what do you call it, position statement, whatever you want to call it. It's a think and action tank specializing in the visual display of spatial information about contemporary cities and events. Spatial information design, which is the official name of the lab, is a name for new ways of working with vast quantities of statistical and other data available about the contemporary city. By reorganizing tabular data, using unique visualization techniques, and locating it geographically, we try to correlate disparate items of information and picture the patterns and networks they create. So, but the most important thing in this is that putting data on the map can open up new spaces for action and new options for intervention as the often unforeseen shapes and forms of life in the city become visible. So for me, that's the most. So we have a lot of publications on the website. This is actually as we were the first project of the lab involved the hiring of a graphic designer who was very involved in the first project, David Reinford, and this is actually part of what he's kind of obsessed with is how ideas and publications are distributed, not in the traditional forms of just books, but that you really actually address an audience through the type of distribution that you're trying to do. So we have lots of publications that we've... Okay. So the main project which has sustained the lab over the last 3 or 4 years, it's not the only project, but it's the kind of project that I'm interested in pursuing, is one which really has, again, started with an issue, and the issue is criminal justice. And it's been displayed in galleries, it's won competitions, it's been in Venice, which I don't have a picture of, it's been at MoMA in the Design and the Elastic Mind, and it's actually become part of the collection there. We've also designed workshops, which are very interdisciplinary, which involve, you know, people from the Department of Corrections, formerly incarcerated people, graphic designers, urban planners, architects, and NGOs to collaborate around these tables. And it's also been at work on the ground, so to speak, in New Orleans, where we've been training high school kids how to make make maps of their own communities. And it's that kind of gradient which can go from the museum to the community, which we're interested in. And you actually don't need to change the communication strategy across these different audiences. And it's really been hugely gratifying. And I would say that. That in that sense, it really has worked. So it's worked at the policy level, it's worked at the communication level, it's worked at the community level, and of course not by myself. I can't take credit for any one of these things. So it's a large network of organizations and people that have really been working on this project. So in terms of our own part of it, the idea is that data is already designed. There's no such thing as a neutral data set. And the data is designed to affect policy. Policy, in fact, affects the built environment, which has an effect on people, which has an effect on the way that data is designed, and that's a certain form of a feedback loop. So this is how we start the projects that we do. We start with this data set about criminal justice, and instead of looking at the crimes that people commit, this is the data that we start... our work from, and it's the data that's collected by the courts as people are incarcerated. And instead of looking at it in terms of the crimes that people commit, we look at it in terms of the home addresses of where people say they have lived before they have been incarcerated. And then we put that data into geographic context, and we draw these maps of how much it costs to keep residents of very select neighborhoods in prison for, we can go into the reasons why they. So in Brooklyn, added up block by block, it costs $359 million to imprison people from Brooklyn. But from a demographic point of view, the spending facilitates what we're calling a mass migration of people to prison, 95% of whom eventually return home. So this is a drawing that connects the home address of someone in prison to where they are incarcerated, in this case, upstate New York. And then when you look at a community district, because the effects of incarceration are so disproportionate, you find out that specific community districts have something like 3.5% of the population, but 8.5% of the prison population. And we look for that kind of concentration in many cities. And then these 11 blocks of Brooklyn are evidence of $11 million being spent that year to incarcerate people from this very poor neighborhood in Brooklyn, and we've called those million-dollar blocks. And that's become the sort of rhetorical frame of the project, which is trying to say that on a financial scale, the prison is becoming the predominant governing institution in the neighborhood, but the money is going outside of the city. And the question we've asked on many different levels, what if more money was spent on these places in the city rather than displacement, what would the city look like? So the first thing we did, and this was, again, in the context of the Architectural League of New York, where we brought together this very interdisciplinary group around these tables and did actually a real live scenario planning workshop coordinated by the Global Business Network. I won't go into that now, but the theme of a scenario planning workshop is that you have axes of very opposite opposite tracks where there's no intersection between the two different axes. And in our case, it was policy and governance, which was my collaborator, Eric Cadora. And from my end, it was design and institutional structure, from a total community where people live and work and sleep like a prison to an open and flexible institution, which we think of as the places that we live. And we gave people a land use map, an urban assets map, and gave them these data cards to coordinate the data with the map, which is why the Global Business Network were interested in working with us, because they always do their exercises around verbal stories, not around visual stories. And by the end of the day, we came up with these four different utopias of what that part of the city, which was Brownsville, Brooklyn, might look like if we thought about incarceration and criminal justice infrastructures differently. My favorite one was the good mall, thinking about big box structures in Brooklyn, and what could you do if they actually worked to enhance a neighborhood rather than work against it. So just to sum up, what we do is find data and repurpose it, and that's what I do creatively in a lot of different projects that I've done since the early 90s. And then mapping, in this case, data for community, for advocacy and communication. And then number three, I'm going to describe to you a project that we did putting this data to get to work in New Orleans, where, you know, as we were saying, we're trying to open up a space for action. And my collaborators who work at the policy level just a couple of weeks ago presented this project to Congress, and there is a lot of support building for this concept, which is called justice reinvestment, taking money from the city, from the prison system, and reinvesting it in neighborhoods and communities which need the money in different ways rather than cycling people back and forth to prison and their neighborhoods. So this is actually a presentation that we made to City Council. Again, it looks precisely the same way as we presented it in the museum, and it really worked effectively at that level, contrary to the fact that everybody says you have to present boring maps in policy arena. So what we were trying to convince them in New Orleans is that infrastructure, the basic facilities, services, and installation needed for the functioning of a community or society, such as transportation, communication systems, water, and power, includes the definition of the word prison, right? So while all architects and, you know, as we know, the Obama administration, everyone is talking about infrastructure right now, and I think it's really important to realize that that prisons are included in that definition, because in the United States, the incarceration levels are the highest, actually, in the world. So it's really not surprising. So this is the map of prison admissions from New Orleans in 2003. We started using the 2003 data because we had it at hand, and it was the data set that you could align with populations, percentages as we knew them before everybody disappeared from the city. And we found certain concentrations in these planning districts, and that, you know, in New Orleans in 2003, it only cost, compared to Brooklyn, it seems like a small amount of money. But that's not the point. The point is that there's a disproportionate incarceration which overlaps with black populations and with poor populations, so that the costs are not evenly distributed. And unconcentrated in very few neighborhoods again and again and again. So what we did was we focused on Central City, and we actually did a time-lapse study of Central City 2003, 2005, 2006, and 2007. And that Central City had 4% of New Orleans' population and 8% of its prison admissions. So at a cost of $4 million, we called it a million-dollar neighborhood. So this is Central City. Probably the light should be down a little bit, but anyway. And the same kind of structure where here are the people. This is the amount it costs to incarcerate one of them and the neighborhood that they lived in. So the point being that the millions of dollars are spent on the neighborhood, but not in the neighborhood. So using maps as tools, our research has focused on defining spatial patterns that link poverty, racial segregation, and incarceration, and how their repeated coincidence takes on identifiable urban forms. We've done this in many cities across the United States. So this happens to be Phoenix in Arizona, Wichita in Kansas, and New Orleans. We've done it in New York, Houston, my collaborators have done it in many, many different cities. And this over here is a grid which shows at every point the highest overlap of incarceration, of poverty, of minority population, and then taking that block and zooming in on it quite randomly, so to speak. And every single block showed up at the intersection of an elevated highway and a boundary between an industrial zone and a residential neighborhood. So in 2007 in New Orleans, although Central City population was estimated at 69% of its pre-Katrina level, public spending on incarceration had reached 82% of its pre-Katrina level, totaling $3.5 million. And this is the neighborhood, and again, the amounts. So what we presented to the city was what if the rebuilding process worked to strengthen communities, change patterns of incarceration, and break the cycle of reentry and return to prison? That's who we presented to. While other public and social infrastructure like education, health, and housing are being radically transformed, the criminal justice infrastructure has been largely ignored. So no matter what you think of what's happened in New Orleans, and we can say repeated failures, it's not the point. It's that there was an imagination for other things transforming, and as this was going on, all you read about in the newspapers was crime increasing and criminal justice structure being propped up by a lot of things. So the city planning process was neglecting to take into account the obstacles that mass incarceration creates for neighborhood stabilization, if you want to call it that. So this is Blakely's target, 17 target plans for the city. And you notice that one little yellow line over there, which has nothing to do with rebuilding, but just renewing that part of Central City. This is a picture of what it looks like, which used to be a center of black entrepreneurship before the highway slashed through it in the 70s. And right now, it's actually the home of many, many not-for-profit organizations who are dealing with criminal justice reform, education reform, like tiny little things. And it's so close to the business district that actually what's going on over there is, and it's so on the high ground, which is why we decided to study it, not, you know, the depths of the lower Ninth Ward, that you actually do have to worry that this is just one part of the city that's going to be gentrified really quickly. So what we did was we created, and it's actually quite conventional in architectural terms, but what we did was we created an asset map of what we call justice reinvestment, what could be called justice reinvestment assets, which linked justice to health organizations, to philanthropy, to civic projects, to recreation, to education, to arts. And as you can see, there are a lot of organizations who are actively working in this area, and we documented them, and then presented again to the city that there was actually a lot in place that if you could just help or add capacity to these very small criminal justice and other organizations, you might actually be able to catalyze change. So to facilitate this, what we did was we coordinated a lot of meetings where we brought together not individuals but organizations, right? And again, I think this links to what Teddy is talking about, where community design is not necessarily bottom up, so to speak, but it's trying to network existing organizations, both local and national. So you're dealing with the system of criminal justice on the one hand and the specificity of the block on the other hand and every level in between. So what you have over here is a lot of different scales of intervention. And yes, we organized a Facebook group, which was, again, not linking individuals but linking organizations to have a relationship with the face-to-face meetings as well. And the project resulted actually in four pilot projects, one which started from the field of health, one which started from the field of justice, one from education, and one from economic development. And the idea was that these programs, which were developed, really overlapped with one another because they were all in Central City, which meant that a large percentage of that population had somehow been touched by the criminal justice system. So with education, it's kids of incarcerated people. In health, it's dealing with drugs, which is oftentimes why people are put in prison, which seems wrong to me, etc. So this we did not design ourselves, but this is a project that actually we brought to the site, which is a mobile health clinic. This is part of the Greater New Orleans Conservancy, which was teaching kids how to map the environmental conditions in their neighborhoods. There's also been established a day reporting center where instead of going to prison or jail, people have to go to this facility where they either get their high school education or they have drug treatment or whatever else they need to do rather than to facilitate their reentry to the neighborhood. So in a sense, what's going on in New Orleans, which is the most dangerous part of all of us, is that actually FEMA has agreed to fund the renovation and expansion of the existing prison. And their projected growth has actually very little to do with the growth of the returning populations. So what we've proposed is that instead of their projected growth, perhaps you could consider a reduction in the prison population, and that the city faces two choices, right? The criminal justice system is either an exostructure of the city where you cycle people to prison and back to their own neighborhood and back again, or else you can think of it as an infrastructure where you network all these organizations together, rebuild the services that are necessary in these neighborhoods, and you know, call that a criminal justice infrastructure. So that's kind of the full scope of the project. So I can either show you a new project or I could stop there, but since I think we went over time in the first half. Yeah? Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know whether this is working. Yeah. Thank you, Laura. We have another set of stellar agents provocateurs, among which William Bevington over here from the Communication Design and Technology School, Brian McGrath in the back, and Jessica Irish over there. So I can pass the mic to whomever wants to start first.
Thank you, Laura.
Welcome.
Well, that was pretty clear, concise, and convincing, so it's going to be hard to be too brutal. Uh-huh. I would say you definitely have to kern those capital ATs on the presentation. There's a lot of spacing there. And some of the word breaks are kind of awkward with the all caps. But going into
spoken like a graphic designer. Okay.
But as an information designer, I would have two issues. One was... again, very clear material, and I would ask that since you've obviously developed some algorithms for running this material and doing the presentations, it would seem that those being packaged and generally available to all the major cities in the United States would allow them to very quickly run all this data without such focused presentations as you've done, right? I mean, you one of the beauties of good information design logic is that those could be then distributed, which I think would be really neat. And then I have a question for you, which is the logic I think is really good, the concept of bringing the infrastructure within the infrastructure, not having this migration in and out. But don't prisons in themselves, aren't they sort of little islands anyway? Like, if how have you found that the prison, or how do you feel that the prison within the community, bringing both money back and the facility back, how does that really interact without being?
Oh no, I'm not talking about bringing the prison back to the city, right? I think that there's since the 70s there have been all kinds of policies and laws which have made it easier to send people to prison. So, and that incarceration is often a response to poverty, not to crime. So the larger project is that that we need to focus our attention on these neglected parts of the city and look at what's there. I don't think we should bring the prisons back to the city.
So just
the total opposite, yeah.
Right. So the pure, in other words, it's like a pure reinvestment of the funds within the
absolutely
community. But you would still have the issue of the migration.
One block at a time. Maybe you can change that. Yeah, I think it's a policy. It's a policy issue. And at the policy level, this project, and again, I take no credit for it at all, has been quite successful. And it's a Bush-Clinton collaboration, and we don't know what Obama's going to do with it. But it's about focusing on people coming home from prison rather than sending people to prison. It's a shift. It's a real shift in focus. So, which from the reason I took it on was because of that. When I saw these, what looked like million-dollar block maps, I wanted to know what's there, what's in, and that's why we do that Zoom. I actually don't want to only see it again and again and again as a pattern in the city. I want to know. It really is about the transparency between the block and the system, right? It's Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses put together. You really have to... You have to deal with both of them. Yeah. And, defensible space is not really an option. It just replicates the policing system. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I'll turn it over to Ms. Irish.
Yeah.
Hi. I guess I was curious to connect your presentation more to the two prior to Rick and Teddy's presentations, which both talked a lot about local knowledge and really understanding the fabric of a certain space. And also in terms of thinking about the digital data sets that you're working with and visualizing those spaces, and now that we're very much in a sort of a 2.0 crowdsourcing capabilities, there's all these new tools that come out every week of making that data available and also visualization tools. What sort of questions do you envision seeing as sort of a crowdsource model specifically for the communities that these people are coming from?
Yeah.
Because, again, why one person? What happens in that one block? What happens in that one house?
Yeah, okay. It's not... Okay.
So instead of looking at the sort of larger zoomed-out map, really getting much more local.
Uh-huh. So, but the project is really about the concentration in a neighborhood, right? Or in whatever you want to define that district as, that has the disproportionate... That shares the disproportionate costs of incarceration. I completely acknowledge the rhetoric of this project. It's very conscious. It probably could not start at the community level unless you had an incredible group of community of maybe people who have been in and out of the prison system who are not the ones that are so capable of representing, right? Because a lot of people want to sweep this under right? At the community level, it's not easy to talk about incarceration, right? And I think that that's actually part of what you have to deal with at a community level. We cannot say, you know, crime maps are very good at doing that, right? They focus city attention and send a police force to a specific address. We're not claiming that this data should become publicly available. It's not publicly available data. We're only allowed to use it in very specialized circumstances. And I'm not sure it should, because people can do good things and bad things, and you have to always be aware of that with every data set, right? People can do good things and bad things with data. And so I'm not sure where this starts at the crowdsourcing level. At the crowdsourcing level, it starts with, you know, conditions of poverty and with environmental injustice and with, you know, that kind of thing, but not necessarily directly with incarceration or with the, but you could talk about the costs of incarceration, but not, yeah. I hope that answers. I think there are a lot of new tools that people can use at the community level, and making their own maps rather than people making maps for them of their own communities could be an incredible tool, but not for the specific, not specifically for this project, which operates at the policy level and the neighborhood level simultaneously. Yeah.
Laura, the questions from the communication designers.
The communication
designers. You can breathe a sigh of relief.
Okay.
Coming from architecture and urban design. And I also want to use this occasion, because I really appreciate, Leticia, the kind of sequence of these presentations. We've gone from the portrait to the community with questions about how to scale up, and your work is really scaling down, and the kind of history of your work from satellite and GPS and remote sensing to GIS is for me really fascinating. And so I guess I want to go at the two questions, research and digital architecture, and maybe include the curators and the provocation, because you're too good of a friend for me.
That's okay. You can
In terms of research, I think I really appreciate Aaron's comment that we have 16 models. You said 16 practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I think models need theoretical frameworks if we are going to begin to understand this work as part of a sign of a larger shifts in architectural practice. And I really did not appreciate the situation of the show within the context of, yet again, Museum of Modern Art and Philip Johnson and international style, but I found it much more provocative today, situating it within a much shorter history of the 70s and the transition to the presence of architecture at the moment of postmodernism at the Venice Biennale. And because the 70s were the, you know, both the moment of the discovery of the megacity by Janice Perelman and the oil crisis, but quickly followed by emergence of the digital world in 1978, electronic trading began in the New York Stock Exchange. So your work is, I think, really critical that everyone understands it in relationship to how architects in the 80s adopted digital tools for the mass production of that bubble boom that we're kind of witnessing the end of the cycle now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to provoke maybe you and the curators, whoever wants to answer the question, about how we can begin to theoretically frame this work with something that began in the 70s with the first oil crisis, was kind of interrupted by the beginning of this boom that was kind of pushed by the digital technologies, and and the reuse of these technologies in much more strategic ways, which is what I really appreciate in your work. And to get at the question to Tony Cruz is, how do we scale up? What about the conflicts? Things like that. I think your work really begins to address those questions. So I guess both the digital architecture and the research question are wrapped together there, because I think I do want to point out that while most architects were grabbing the modeling and Maya and rendering and things like that, you grabbed GPS and remote sensing and
GIS. Yeah, I was always behind, yeah.
Always ahead.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm not. I think it's a comment more than a question, which I really appreciate. But as you know, again, as a for me, it's actually becoming irritating having to frame my work always in terms of architecture. Or I'm becoming less comfortable with it as time goes on, and I think as I get less comfortable about it, I'm more confident in the work itself that it is addressing architecture, because it is addressing spatial questions. It's working at multiple scales. It's using data critically and opening up new ways of seeing urban space, and there's always been a place for that in architecture, in the practice of architecture, so in that, it's where is the first speaker who was saying he's an artist and not a planner? If he were a planner, perhaps we would get further in urban planning, which is so locked up in bureaucracy and in all the very complex things that urban planners have to do, and particularly in their dismissal of design or dismissive attitude to presenting information and using it critically, etc. So I think we're all so locked into our own fields that in fact we don't let them influence each other enough. And so so for me, the one question leads to another. And if you ask me, where this prison work, I think I'm going to be doing this prison work actually for quite a while. It's hard to let go once you start. But it's not architecture, with a capital A, definitely not. It's not community design with a little c either. It's somewhere much more multivalent, and it's also teaching people in criminal justice how to use architectural tools. It's teaching people in education that you have to teach people with new tools. So maybe that's mainly what I do, is a didactic practice. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hi.
I find your work very interesting, I'm mostly curious about. I've been closely working with geographers, right? And these are things that I've seen in geography done for quite a while. I mean, basically, this is the work of a geographer, the way I see it. Mm-hmm. Basically, the question is. How do you differentiate the work of a geographer, which in, for example, the
what
previous question...
What does a geographer do?
Map.
Map. And what do they do? What do they do with their maps?
Well, that's a question. Relating to the previous question, where the work of a geographer, since it's considered social science, they really follow very strict methodologies, and theoretical frameworks, And I'm just very curious to see what is your perspective on the work that a geographer does today.
Yeah.
And the work that you're doing in terms of...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Right, So first of all, this project uses GIS, and it uses geographers use GIS, but this is used in a very rhetorical way, and it's meant to be used in a rhetorical way. The next project I was going to show you had uh, nothing nothing to do with GIS, but a lot to do with mapping, right? So I just want to show you it. Just I want to show it for Teddy, actually. This is the remittances stuff. So it's not always, you know, so the prison project GIS is used because it's meant to show this invisible geography, and, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, maybe not. I'm not 100%, we could argue about that. So yes, but I'm not a geographer, you know, and I think that's social scientists, although I do actually, I like the relationship between social science and architecture that was invented in the 70s, but often it was for huge mega structural projects and for system-wide change. So this project over here, which was a global, it was about mapping global data, right, which you could take back to Doxiadis and, you know, all those people, but we were much more trying to show inconsistencies and inequities and the collapse between the global map, and not going through it to the local scale, but to the local data within the map, which, right? So yeah, it's using mapping and geography to expose geographic spaces, and I'm much more willing to make mistakes than a social scientist would if it, you know, if you can use that mistake critically and, you know, with the good intention of making that mistake. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take one more question, and then we're going to get to question four.
Thank you. Actually, I had the great privilege of drafting the original call for proposals that resulted in this exhibition. Uh-huh. And so I come at this from a very different perspective. My goal was to elicit works that would demonstrate the ways in which architecture and the expanded form of architecture could affect public policy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you could share with us some of the ways in which you have or would like to present million-dollar blocks mm-hmm. in a policy setting, and okay. what the response that you've received has been.
Okay. I only presented it myself in a policy setting in New Orleans to the city council, and they were really compelled by the data-driven presentation. You know, which they are trained to get, right. So that's why I say this is a rhetorical project, okay? So I work with these people. I would not have the data were it not for this group called the Council of State Governments and the Justice Mapping Center, who have for the last 20 years tried to change, have done criminal justice reform work. Right, and the project is funded by the Open Society Institute, and it was funded by the JET Foundation, and so they bring together a whole network of, they're kind of a client, so to speak, because they really do, foundations really do bring together networks of experts. And so at the policy level, I can't tell you that it's going to happen, of course I can't, you know, but it has had... in the state of Texas, in the state of Kansas, in the state of Michigan, a lot of these states have committed to reducing their prison budgets in ways that are responsible to the communities from which the prisoners return to. And so there's also an act called the Second Chance Act, which, if the money gets appropriated, will fund a lot of reentry projects, and they're trying to do a Justice Reinvestment Act. This is all work that I'm not doing myself, but I often help with the maps, and I've become kind of an advocate. I have become, through doing the work, I have become an advocate for the project. Yeah. Yeah, they're very mundane. Yeah,
well, that's what good communication does, no?
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, with a lot of help. Yeah, you know, because I obviously, I obviously didn't do this just as an information designer. I did it as somewhat drawn in by the work. Yeah. So that's
Thank
why
you.
Issue driven rather than research, right. You know, that yeah. Right.